Hey, it's John, and you've probably heard me talk about True Diagnostics' True Age Test. My results were a game changer, but have you tried it? Here's why I think you should. Many of the health risks that accompany aging are in your control. The True Age Test didn't just give me a number, it showed me how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. It was eye-opening. The test will give you tailored tips from Ivy League scientists, like tweaking diet and sleep, to slow aging and cut risks. As a result, I started taking more vitamin C and a mushroom supplement that seems to be helping me with focus and overall health. It was so easy, a quick at-home finger prick, send it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, I got a detailed report. No doctor, no hassle. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
The purchase of American land by either foreign investors or major private equity funds. This is a secular trend. I mean, I think people comment on Bill Gates buying up, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. But in most states in this country, it's entirely legal for Chinese investors to buy vast swaths of acreage in America. Same thing with private equity funds. And at some point, that consolidation of ownership also becomes a threat to our Republican form of governance. Land ownership cultivates an ownership mentality. It's a place where you practice virtue and practice self-governance, even over a very small sphere.
Welcome once again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. We have a special guest today who's actually been on the podcast before, Josh Abbottoy. He is the executive director for American Reformer. He is the president of Ridge Runner USA. You can go to ridgerunnerusa.com and find out more about land in Berksville, Kentucky, in Greensboro, Tennessee. And if you want to follow him on X, it's BYZNES, business, spelled differently, obviously. And he's going to talk today about the network state and, land, I guess. That's his thing anyway, right? Land. And as a developer, I think he's got a lot of good information to share with us, especially in the wake of Senator Mike Lee's proposal that he withdrew. So we're going to talk about these this land out west, what could be done with it, American cities, and then what is the digital age have to say about these things. So without further ado, Josh Abbottoy, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much, John. It's always always good to be here. Yeah.
So Senator Mike Lee obviously withdrew this proposal. And at the time people are listening to this, because this is a recording, it'll probably be maybe a week since that he's withdrawn this proposal. But people were really fighting about it. There were fractures going on in conservative circles over this. And I dipped my toe in and found myself being shot at from both ends. I was a little surprised. Maybe let's talk about that, because there's all this land out west. A lot of it's federal. You look at the size of the federal land in Arizona and Nevada, for example, and it's like, it's such a large percentage. I think it's like 80% of the state in Nevada. It's insane. Land under federal control, whether that's like Bureau of Land Management land or state land that was then federalized, meaning the federal government has all these regulations and states can't do what they want to do with it. And, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, obviously put a lot of that in. And anyway, it's sitting there. Shouldn't we do something with it? Why should the federal government just have it? So I have some sympathy with Mike Lee, but of course people freaked out that corporations are going to just buy this land up and it'll be our enemies. It'll be Chinese corporations and that kind of thing. So what are your thoughts on that? And, what's the alternative?
Yeah. So look, I mean, for years, decades, really, like the standard conservative line on government land was the federal government owns way too much land. And just to really steel man it, it's a serious like state sovereignty issue. If you're in a state where the federal government owns over like 80% of the land surface, think about that. Like your state government controls effectively 20% of the state, with the balance being, you know, controlled out of Washington, D.C. And so like the government of a state that's in a situation like that is actually much less powerful to actually affect the physical surroundings of the citizens of its state than the federal government that was just sitting
bureaucrat
across the country. Right. And that's, you know, that is in our federal system, we want sovereign states. We want states that act like, you know, like sovereigns, like they control their territories and to have have a semblance of power over their holdings. And so like it, you know, the standard conservative critique is this, you know, this federal ownership actually undermines federalism. And then in addition to that, of course, you have all the issues, you know, that come with government ownership. You know, often you have mismanagement or underutilization. So in a lot of the Western states, Idaho, for example, I have good friends there who talk about how the federal government has gotten very negligent in managing the forests in a way that would mitigate forest fires and things like that. So there's a lot of, you know, if you're a citizen of one of these states, there's a lot of reasons why you actually might want the federal government to sell that land to the right person. But again, I think that the reaction to Lee's proposal, I think, underscores some ways that like the Republican Party has changed in the last 10 years. So first of all, I mean, he was proposing roughly 3 million acres be sold, scattered around the country, but a lot of it was actually in some nicer areas, some areas in the mountains in Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. These are places that really struck an emotional nerve because they're not national parks, but they're close. They're places that some of them had ecological significance. And, you know, and so just from a conservation angle, a number of conservatives were worried about that. You know, I'll just stop and point out there is a resurgent interest in conservationism on the right. A lot of this goes back to Teddy Roosevelt, who was a populist. He was the original antitrust guy. He was also the national parks guy. And as Republicans have sort of rediscovered Teddy Roosevelt's philosophy, I think a number of them are actually a little bit more interested in this idea that, you know, we should reserve a portion of the public land that can be accessible to all members of the public. And it helps to build national cohesion and pride. We've got a beautiful continent. Let's save part of it and keep it in its natural state. And that's good for national identity. It's a gift, and some of it should be protected for all generations. So that's part of what's going on. But then the other big thing that's going on is much of the defense of this move was actually predicated around how can we expand affordable housing? And that's a fraught argument right now, too, because, you know, just like the vice president said on the campaign trail, illegal immigration is actually a massive driver for housing costs. I mean, if you think about it, you know, if 12 million people illegally entered the country under Biden, that's a massive proportion of our population, but it's actually even larger if you compare it to the number of people who are looking for new housing, right? I mean, in any given 5-year period, you know, maybe 10 or 15 million Americans are going to be on the market for buying a house because they've gotten married or they've, you know, gotten a job. Well, if suddenly they're competing against, 12 million, illegal immigrants who would not otherwise be in this country, but for breaking the law, all of a sudden, you know, you're sort of like doubling the number of people that are looking for a house. You're doubling the supply side. And so, of course, that's going to drive prices up. And so I think with some good reason, MAGA folks have said the solution to affordable housing is actually enforcing our immigration laws. And if we do that, then we're going to see housing affordability really improve. And then finally, I'd say that the third issue that's been in the news for years now is the purchase of American land by either foreign investors or major private equity funds. This is a secular trend. I mean, I think people comment on Bill Gates buying up, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. And you know, in most states in this country, some states have tried to pass laws to prohibit this, but in most states in this country, it's entirely legal for Chinese investors to buy vast swaths of acreage in America. Same thing with private equity funds. And at some point, that consolidation of ownership also becomes a threat to our Republican form of governance because, J.D. Vance actually spoke very convincingly this on the campaign trail. But our ethos, even at our founding until today, has been that land ownership cultivates an ownership mentality. It's a place where you practice virtue and practice self-governance, even over a very small sphere. And of course, from that, it helps you to build civic virtue, the kind of virtue that you carry with you to the voting booth or to the to when you serve on a jury and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was great. I pretty much agreed with everything you said. I think I'm an admirer of Roosevelt, which gets me in trouble with maybe some Southern conservative types. I accept the critiques of his progressive era leanings, and I would prefer that these national parks be controlled by states. And it's easy to say that sitting in New York, where one of the largest state park areas is the Adirondack Park. It's the size of, it's actually bigger than I think any national park, if I'm not mistaken. It's huge. And it's state controlled and that kind of thing. And I would prefer to see that in these federal lands, but I get it, right? I get it. I love the national parks and I'm a very much a conservationist. And so to think about some of these places being purchased by foreign interests is very disturbing. That these are, in a sense, these are sacred places. They are part of our national identity and our story. And just there needs to be, I think, a mechanism for retaining these for future generations. And there should be common lands too. I think in most agrarian societies, that's been common grazing lands and that kind of thing. And I know there's even areas in Europe where that's still managed with, like, who owns it? Well, the community does, because we've been using it for generations and we've been stewarding it well. So there's no reason to have laws come in and regulate these things because we already have arrangements. But in America, where things, I think, developed so quickly, and we had massive groups of settlers come. And I mean, it's maybe a bad example, but you know, the kid who, when you're growing up, like, you know, puberty just hits him. Like, he's just like, one day he's a kid, and like a week later, it's like, what happened? Your voice dropped, you got muscles, right? You know, it's like America's like that. America's like the kid that grew up so fast. And when you grow up that fast, you know, you end up tripping and you're not used to mm-hmm. being the size you are. And I feel like America is still tripping a little bit. And this is maybe one of the manifestations of that, is like, we don't know what to do with this land. Exactly.
Yeah. But we're very bimodal. Yeah. I mean, we like the, as you know, on the eastern side of the country, we've got barely any public lands at all. Right.
Hardly any.
Except for the, you know, a smattering of state parks and a couple national parks. But then you get out west, and you can get to states where the federal government owns over 70% of all the landmass. And so it's a little bit schizophrenic. It's like we had figured it out by the time we got out there. And also, frankly, you know, in places like Nevada, like, you're never going to have the density that you would out east. You're not going to have the small farmsteads that, you know, sort of represented the settlement pattern out this way. In the west, you know, population would cluster along rivers, or, you know, usually it was water driven, and that's a small slice of these states. So it's never going to be exactly in parity, I don't think. But I think it is kind of a weird situation at the same time to go from a state like Tennessee, I think under 1% of our surface area is like under a park and the rest is private, you know, to go all the way to a state like Nevada, which is, you know, very heavily tilted the other way.
Yeah, we actually have some land trusts in my area. That if you came and visited, Josh, I would probably show you, because you, I mean, being the lover of land that you are, we have a very pastoral scenery, and there's something to be said for the Hudson Valley and the Dutch settlement and everything. Mm. But there's this group called Scenic Hudson, and it's a land trust, and it's not the only land trust, by the way, but it's probably one of the big ones in my area. And they have acquired a lot of land, especially along the river, and preserved it. And I am so in favor of what they're doing. There's also the Mohawk Preserve near me. It's and I know they probably get incentives and tax cuts and all sorts of things that enable them to do this. Actually, they probably aren't taxed. I would assume I don't know how they have it arranged. I haven't really looked into it, but they're managed very well, is what I'm trying to say, though. Mm-hmm. And it's people who care about the issue. There's, you know, public donations and public volunteer work, and I don't know what every state looks like, but that's one of the things, even though I'm in a blue state, that I have to say is done very well. And I've wondered whether or not something similar can happen out west, where you can have these private organizations that are controlled by Americans who are local, that live in the area, that can manage these things, or the state governments can manage them, or you can make some of it private, but with stipulations that Americans have to be the ones who purchase this. So maybe walk us through some options. What are the solutions you see to this problem?
Yeah. So I think that, I think you should, I think, so just cards on the table. I think the federal government should sell some of its Western land. But it needs to do so in a very thoughtful way that takes into account. I mean, so first of all, you know, start in the states where the federal government owns the highest proportion of land. So start, you know, basically start working down and letting those states get a little bit closer to parity with the average American state in terms of private ownership. But in so doing, prioritize the areas where federal negligence is actually a nuisance to local residents. So, you know, I gave the example earlier of mismanaged Idaho forests and the forest fire problem that tends to spring from that. A lot of that is because, you know, the federal government's not clearing out the undergrowth. They let it all pile up until all of a sudden, you know, bam, there's a catastrophic major fire that's extremely difficult to control. If there were much more frequent controlled burns, then you wouldn't get the catastrophic mega fires that you tend to get right now. Similar to the California issue, which people talk about a lot. You know, so that's a place where you're going to get a lot of like local political will behind it. You know, if you're trying to say, hey, we're selling the federal land for the good of the citizens of this state, but then the citizens of the state are opposing you, that's a bad sign, right? So politically, like you need to get the citizens of that state behind it. But further than that, you know, I think that you'd be better off selling rather than selling, you know, millions of acres peppered throughout the whole country, sell some large tracts in a couple of places and try to reduce it to a discrete number of sales that happen. And the main reason you're doing that is because you actually want the federal, you want a commission appointed by Trump, hopefully with good advisors on it, evaluating bids to purchase the land. And it's going to be a lot more than just the purchase price. You're going to want them to evaluate their conservation plans, right? So if, let's say the federal government wants to sell 100,000 acres in the Nevada desert, then, you know, me or any other developer who wants to put a bid in, as part of that process, we would show that we're financially capable of doing it. But then we'd also have to show, here's what our conservation plans are. And if you really wanted to get ambitious, and I think you should do this, I think this would be a wonderful thing. You could actually push the bidders also to say, you've got to add a component to your development plans for how this will conserve not only nature, but how it will celebrate American history in this particular region, right? So you can have a cultural component to it as well, make it competitive, and get people, you know, in a virtuous competition for owning that land. So at the end of the day, you can, you know, hopefully you sell land where good developers are going to build something that's like nationally inspiring and all the rest. I mean, because here's the thing. I mean, this is where I'm most sympathetic to selling federal land. We, like in America, we've got a lot of aging cities that have heavy regulation. And, you know, a lot of them are have been at various stages of their growth, like determined by technological advancement, right? So like you get the inner city, and then you get the suburbs that sprung up once cars were available and all the rest. And you know, you end up having these major metropolitan areas where it's really difficult to fundamentally re-engineer how they look and feel. But as we, you know, as we move into the 21st century, it's like, you know, I think it's actually something that would be very inspiring for the nation to be able to say, we are still capable of building beautiful, human-friendly, human-scale cities. You know, because it's just that much of the country that's no longer really possible. And so, yeah, like that's where, you know, I think you probably could do this and probably could get the political will. You know, and then, but just push towards a more discrete number of bids where you can do a qualitative assessment, have a presidential commission that reviews the applications. I mean, it's almost like a grant application, you know, reviews the proposals and awards them to the most worthy applicants.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, these American cities. So I'm actually pretty unfamiliar with this idea, although I've heard about it before.
Just like animal predators aim for the slowest prey, hackers target people with the weakest security. And if you're not using ExpressVPN, that's you. It doesn't take much technical knowledge to hack someone. Just some cheap hardware is needed. A smart 12-year-old could do it. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's easy to use. Fire up the app and click one button to get protected. Works on all devices, phones, laptops, tablets, and more, so you can stay secure on the go. And ExpressVPN is the VPN service I use on my desktop and iPhone. I believe it's important to put gates around the things we love, not just our homes or our country, but also our digital information. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/conversations. That's expressvpn.com/conversations to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months free. expressvpn.com/conversations.
I'll start off with like what I know. China has these centrally planned cities, right, that are ghost towns. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And skyscrapers and office buildings and condos and the whole bit. And they, with the intention that people would live there, and no one lives there. And so that's one of the things libertarians especially bring up as, look at the failures of central planning and government planning. What are you, how is what you're saying different? You would take a land, you would take an area.
It would be a bid process. So the development's driven by the market, by private actors. There are some good use cases. So the Freedom City concept was floated briefly in Trump's first administration. Obviously during Biden, it was shelved. And with Trump getting back in the White House, there's been a renewed effort to push on policy, whether legislative or regulatory, to enable Freedom Cities to come into existence. The basic concept is that it doesn't have to be on existing federal land. You could even take privately owned land and sell it to the government, and then they lease it back to you. But the basic concept of a Freedom City is that it gives you a space where you can actually get selective regulatory relief. So for example, you know, if you were a drone manufacturer and you wanted to innovate in drones, right now the FAA regulations that would cover you in most parts of the country are extremely burdensome. But if you were able to, you know, buy a property in a tucked away place that planes never fly over, and you could get a carve out from FAA regulation, then you could, you know, do more aggressive testing of drones. The origination of this concept was really driven by the insight, which I think is fundamentally true, that America is a bit less competitive because of a heavy regulatory burden. And so if you could create very selective niche carve outs to some of those regulatory burdens, you can enable innovation to happen. And this often happens in hubs, right? So like, if you've got a drone company in one location, then you're going to want all the companies that make the component parts, and you're going to want the software company. You're going to want all of that in physical proximity for efficiency. And so the thought was, really, if we want to reindustrialize and see real hard tech innovation, we're going to need new industrial hubs where you have all those different players coming together in the same geographic space, and also have the regulatory freedom to be able to move quickly and get things off the ground quickly. Another great example, if you had a Freedom City that was centered around chip manufacturing, right, a huge geopolitical issue that we need help on. And I think you could get political will to carve that out, to lessen regulatory burdens where it makes sense, and really unleash construction for a chip hub. Yeah, those are some of the examples. That was really the political impetus behind it. But then, you know, further, again, the cultural angle I'm articulating is essentially a Freedom City can also be something that inspires a new sense of optimism in Americans. In other words, we are capable as a nation of standing up very quickly factories and these cities to meet critical needs in the emerging technology space.
So everyone would want to be part of that if there's limited regulations, but they would have to bid, or they'd have to pay something to be part of this project.
Yeah. I mean, well, most likely there'd be a developer and their application would include probably already indications of interest from manufacturers. And, you know, if they, that gotcha. you would have to evaluate the reality of their proposal. Like, do they have real companies that are ready to move and join this thing? And do they have, you know, have they thought about all of the parts of the ecosystem that they need? And then you'd evaluate that and approve based on which one is in the aggregate net going to be advance American interests overseas, you know, as well as all the cultural components I mentioned.
I know there's a nervousness out there about smart cities where you would have a lot of cameras and AI and abilities to, I don't know, turn off, you know, traffic lights based on AI calculations instead of human a reaction. And, you know, I don't know if this plays into that at all. I mean, it doesn't sound like this concept doesn't sound like it deals with that, but any kind of a new city, I think, would have a lot of innovative technology that would be used that, you know, potentially could be used to, even though it's a freedom city, if it got into the wrong hands, it could be used to limit freedom.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of that is, I don't think any of that, I don't think the security and privacy concerns are like intrinsic to freedom cities. In other words, you know, a lot of them could be retrofitted over existing cities as well. And, right. you know, there's nothing in the freedom city concept that sort of expressly, you know, that intrinsically calls for those sorts of steps. So it's really more just, that's an area where we're going to need to be vigilant in any new construction, I would say, is like, if we want to continue to limit or restrain the government's ability to surveil us, to surveil our movements, and all of that, you know, that's an issue we need to be watching across the board, you know, because, I mean, the reality, you know, a lot of international cities, as you know, like London, I mean, I think almost every inch of London is on security camera, CCTV, that's very quickly accessed. You know, they certainly have the capability to track somebody's movements very closely. And that's an ancient city. Right. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, I think it's more a question of just the American people retaining the will to fight for their rights as citizens, for their privacy. And I am confident, you know, that is, you know, there in a lot of areas, you know, Americans are struggling, you know, but we are still very strong on this desire to protect, especially our privacy rights, rights to along those lines. So I would say it's definitely something to watch, but I think there's reason to believe that these are not going to turn into, you know, sort of surveillance state bubbles.
Now, you mentioned when we were talking about this, the network state, and I'm curious to know how that, like what it has to do with these freedom cities, or does it have to do with, was that just another topic you
wanted? Yeah, I mean, it's often lib journalists who write about freedom cities often conflate the network state and freedom cities. But what, I mean, partly what we're talking about here in the emerging development of new cities, and I mean, even my company, Ridge Runner, is an example of this, but fundamentally what's going on is with digital technology, one, it's decoupling for many Americans the question of like, where do I work from where must I live? And so that, you know, that that change opens up a lot of new options for people. And one of the things that they're doing, like, and they're revealing this preference, is they're saying, we want to, like, their affinity plays a heavy role in where we choose to live. And, you know, you can see that on a very broad with a broad lens by looking at the Big Sort, right? And the fact that, you know, it's just accelerating since 2020. It's not slowing down. There's still millions of Americans that want to move. And increasingly, they're citing political and cultural factors in the reason why they move, right? So conservative Californians are leaving California and moving to Idaho or Tennessee or Florida, and vice versa. It's a two-way street. So the network state is one way to, it's basically an exercise by a venture capitalist, Balaji Srinivasan, to say, here's where I think this is going politically. So he definitely believes that the internet and digital conditions are going to foster sort of new types of political organization where people who have political affinities all across the world network together and in a way that transcends existing, you know, boundaries and borders. And they work together, you know, it could be a subset within a particular nation or even an international movement. And that ultimately, you know, this digital technology is driving to a place where there's lots of different opt-in societies across the world, right? And so, you know, if you wake up and you say, I'm a Christian nationalist, you join the Christian nationalist network state. And if you wake up and you say, I'm a, you know, I'm a libertarian Bitcoin maximalist, you join the libertarian Bitcoin maximalist state. So it's an exercise in future casting, trying to see where is digital technology sort of taking the future of political arrangements. And I think there's some interesting critiques to be made of his thesis as well. I'm actually somewhat skeptical of the idea that you can have an opt-in society. I think that part of what makes a society is that people don't choose. They're just put into it and then they grow up with it, right? So that's very much a Burkean view. I think, but I will say Balaji is very insightful fundamentally on the dynamic of how the internet is increasing demand for more tribal affiliation. And, you know, you see this in, a number of the charter city attempts are centered around a particular lifestyle, right? So, you know, there's a company named Praxis that's raised $500 million from some very big investment funds to found a city based around the classical virtues of heroism. That's literally like straight from their website. And what is that? I mean, it sounds wacky, but that is a company that's looking out to the future and they are making a bet that that increasing number of numbers of consumers are going to choose where they live based on the vibes, based on the ethos that animates that place. So like within that, I think even something more modest like the Freedom Cities are swimming in this culture where a lot of people who follow real estate and technology are realizing that, you know, basically it's right now is a more has more potential for new development along new lines than has existed maybe, you know, since World War II. I mean, really since World War II, the trend has been suburbanization of America. And, you know, now I think people are saying, wow, I can aggregate demand on the internet and buy an island in the Mediterranean and build a city. And it's possible to do things like that today in a way that it really wasn't even 20 years ago, let alone 100 years ago.
Yeah, as a good Burkean, I don't like what I'm hearing in some ways. I don't know, the limitless choices and being able to be, there's part of me that obviously wants the escape hatch for people under tyranny and wants to find your people, but it's got to be your people. It can't, I don't know. We already do this, right? I mean, this is already a thing that we have found each other online and some... I explain it like this way, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Like online dating, right? It's not ideal, in my opinion, at all, but it may be necessary at times. It may be the best option at times. And when you the success of online dating is whether or not you actually are able to make contact in the real world and forge a relationship that lasts and build a family and the rest, right? It's not you don't want to remain in the online world, right? That's not the goal of that particular tool. And I think the same thing with what you're doing with Ridge Runner, it's about getting to this community. And you even said, it's not about buying a plot in Brewington. Although we want people to buy plots in Brewington, it's just about getting to be with people that share your values, your classic traditional American values, especially if you're deprived of that in the area you live because it's changed under your feet. And so that's like, I don't know, that seems like it's different than the network state, but it is a self-sort, right? And it is, I guess I would evaluate the success of the network state based on that, right? If it, does it actually make a tangible groundfall that can produce a mechanism for people who are born into a society, as Burke would say, rather than a constant array of choices. And you could, because what you're describing, it sounds like you could just jump from network state to network state and I guess be experiment and be out there. And I don't know, we're only given one life. Well, so,
yeah, I mean, I think that, Yeah, so I think that the challenges with the network state thesis are similar to the challenges that liberalism has, in the sense that, like, look at Europe. Okay, Europe used to be heavily Christian in its public square, and then following really over the course of the 20th century, it de-Christianized, and it's liberal now, right? So it's sort of they have a secularism. You leave your comprehensive viewpoints in your house when you enter the public square in Europe. And now, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a surge of Islamic migration. And, you know, it turns out in these societies, like, Islam is expansionary. It's capable of passing its values on to the next generation. And so Europe's built a neutral marketplace of ideas. And it turns out, you know, the viewpoint that's very assertive and aggressive is winning over and against the people who don't bring their values into the public square. And, right. You know, so too, I think with the network state thesis, I think if you gamed it out, I think communities that don't treat like membership as if it's merely an opt-in thing, if they believe, no, you know, I was born into this and I have a duty to it and I have kids and I'm going to raise them as if they're part of this community. Those sorts of societies, I would think, would beat out opt-in societies over time. So yeah, like, again, I'm skeptical of the some aspects of the overall thesis, but I do think it's very insightful at explaining what's happening politically, even now in our country. It partly explains, I think, why the big sort happens, right? I mean, you get a viral story about, you know, how liberal California is. And then we might get a viral story about how some sheriff in Tennessee was, like, standing up for freedom. And, you know, thousands of people will move on the basis of a viral story like that. In fact, in one way, Knoxville, Tennessee, where Glenn Jacobs was the mayor, Glenn was a staunch defender of liberty during the COVID lockdowns. And Knoxville has been exploding since 2020. So that's sort of a small example, just substantiating these dynamics. Digital conditions accelerate that. And so I think especially when you're in a country like ours and in a state where there's a lot of political flux and political disagreement, digital conditions can help to accelerate people's sorting and, you know, looking for places that are going to be a better fit. Again, I think with the goal long term is that, you know, people are going to get established, they're going to put down roots, and, you know, ultimately they're going to help, you know, a real human society is going to congeal in a particular place over time.
Right, right. Yeah. So to wrap this up, to kind of put a cap on it, obviously we're past Senator Mike Lee's proposal, and we're
yeah.
What's the next thing? What do you expect to happen? Do you think these freedom cities are going to, in the Trump administration, become an actual on the ground reality? Or do you think, what do you think happens?
Yeah, I think it will. You know, I think that there's a little bit of, you know, I think that the freedom city, people who follow this and are interested in it, I think we need to, like, do a good job of articulating how this idea is different than the Lee proposal, right? And so if this is brought back to the public, I think you need to have very clear messaging about the criteria by which you're going to sell land to people, and really lead with the, you know, the pro-America, America first rationales for why this is a good idea. And I think there's a heavy reindustrialization theme here where, you know, we are, you know, where we really want to enable innovation that will help us stay competitive with China, like in a geopolitical struggle to build chips and build drones. That's a huge part of this. So, yeah, I think that I don't think you've heard the last of freedom cities. I think that people are going to be talking about this for the remainder of Trump's term. And I hope this is sort of a good explanation to people who haven't followed it closely. You know, what's really driving it is a desire for America to be able to quickly build industrial commercial capacity to compete with China and other players who are doing the same.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, if people want to find out more about what Josh Abbotoy has to say, check him out. You can go to BYZNESS on X. That's his handle. Business. You can go to RidgeRunnerUSA.com if you're interested in the community there in Gainesboro, Tennessee. And of course, you can also go to American Reformer. So with that, thanks, Josh. Appreciate it.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.